Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Yesterday, Anthony Albanese announced the official date for the referendum on The Voice. Over the next 44 days, the no and yes side will try to convince Australians about why we don't or do need The Voice. Referendums used to be a regular occurrence in Australia, with 44 held last century. So far this century, zero, nothing. If The Voice is successful, it will not only be the first referendum this century, but the first successful one since 1977. It will also be the first successful referendum without bipartisan support. Why is The Voice important, and how should our media cover what is looking increasingly like a toxic debate? Two Australians who are on the yes side of the ledger are Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien. Thomas Mayo is an Indigenous leader and writer, and he is a proud Kurrag, Kukagul, Yurrbum, Torres Strait Islander man. And Kerry O'Brien is a journalist and former host of 7:30. Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thank you, Anthony.
So yesterday, Anthony Albanese announced the date to the Voice referendum. So here we are. We're up and running. This moment has been a long time coming. Thomas, what were your feelings yesterday when the date was finally official?
It was a really exciting day. There's been so much hard work done for this opportunity that Australia will have now, you know, on the 14th of October. There's been over 100 years of efforts by Indigenous people to take responsibility for our lives, to improve, you know, not just the relationship with broader Australia, but to improve the conditions around housing and employment and health, all of those things. And we've established voices many times. So we've learned the lessons that those voices have always been silenced. And then we worked hard to reach a consensus back in 2017, bringing those lessons together, you know, coming to an agreement that is in the Uluru Statement from the heart to propose a constitutionally enshrined voice. And then finally, in the lead up to this moment, just, you know, working hard to convince all political persuasions to come on board and give us this opportunity. And thankfully last year, Labor made that commitment. And, you know, so it was really exciting moment to know that we are going to the polls and the invitation in the Uluru Statement is going to get a response from the Australian people.
Now, the two of you have written a book called The Voice to Parliament Handbook. It's a kind of self-help book for voters. How did the two of you come to work together, and why did you feel the need for this book?
Thomas had the idea in travelling around the countryside for 6 years as a man on a mission, first with the actual canvas itself as an education process, and then more recently attuned to explaining the importance of this referendum and what's behind it. But Thomas and I got to know each other a little because we had a couple of conversations, public conversations around earlier books of his, also related to the Uluru Statement from the Heart. And late last year, Thomas invited me along on the process of writing what he saw, and I agree, is designed as a simple handbook to based very carefully in fact, and to explain the background to The Voice, explain what purposes it would serve, and to resolve misunderstandings for those people who might feel that they want to vote yes but don't feel that they completely understand it, or in fact have become concerned because of aspects of the No campaign, some of the confusions that have arisen from what the No campaign have been saying, and how we can answer really practical questions for people and help them to better understand why it is so important for this country to embrace the Uluru Statement and the spirit and letter of the Uluru Statement through this referendum.
Thomas, you've been all around the country. Why do you feel that this book was needed?
Yeah, I learned pretty early in the campaign that you can't take it for granted that people are going to understand how to advocate for something like this. You know, we need non-Indigenous people to walk with us on this. So we're not going to win it alone as, you know, merely just over 3% of the population. You know, Indigenous issues, Indigenous culture is something that a lot of Australians are unaware of, even if they do, you know, want to support us. And, you know, a lot of Indigenous, a lot of Australians don't even have, you know an Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander person in a way that, you know, where they are close to any of us. You know, it says Noel Pearson described the most unloved Australians, you know. Few people know us and are easily, you know, convinced of the worst about us, basically. So, you know, I thought that I really needed to help people to understand. The other thing is I also knew that people that would want to support us may never have campaigned before. And we're seeing that, you know, in this now with over 30,000 volunteers in the campaign, that many have never been involved or politically active in their lives. And so, you know, that was the idea of the book, to give people the tools that they need to get out there and help us to succeed at this referendum.
Kerry, this is the first referendum this century. Was one of your motivations to educate voters on something many of them have never taken part in?
Well, I think, I mean, look, I've been a journalist for more than 50 years and I've seen a lot of enlightenment in this country in that time, but I've also seen a lot of ignorance. There are a lot of people, you know, there are a lot of very good people out there who are so busy in their lives, just doing basic things, just keeping their head above water, just looking after themselves and their families and their immediate responsibilities. And it's an increasingly complex world. And I understand it that, and the media is going through a very difficult time too, where the old traditional models of media in this country have gone out the window in the digital age. And the mainstream media in this country is not as strong as it once was. And at times it falls down on its job. And I'm a part of that industry. I understand it very well. I see our failures. And this to me, having covered Indigenous issues and having seen the problems close up for the whole of my working lifetime, I do understand how important it is, what an important opportunity this is to actually make positive change, not just for Indigenous people, not just to do things like closing the gaps of serious inequity on really fundamental social issues like housing and health and education and so on. Those things that allow us to, that become the building blocks of our lives, that it's too important to me to sit on the sidelines and not help the process of understanding the history behind this, the elements that have driven the Uluru Statement from the heart, the things that we believe based on our knowledge of what has happened in the past, what has worked and what hasn't worked and why, to be able to help to provide some enlightenment to people as they make their decisions on how to vote in this referendum. And anybody who's under, I think, 42 years of age has never voted in a referendum. And I think there's a lot of ignorance around that. I've learned that just traveling around the country with Thomas. We've been everywhere in this country over the last few months, and you go out of your way to ask people if they know what a referendum is even. And often I'm shocked by the lack of knowledge and basic understanding on these things, and these are part of the building blocks of our democracy.
And look, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because last century there was 44 referendums, 8 succeeded. The first 20 years of the last century there were 13 referendums. Now we've gone almost more than 2 decades without a referendum. Do you think the lack of referendums is due to them being seen as too hard, or is it more a lack of ambition and imagination for what this country could be?
Oh, I think that's a part. These are big questions, Anthony. But and you know, I mean, I still struggle to get a complete sense of understanding of my own nation today. I mean, we've been a nation of infinite possibilities. The things that we have promised to be and often fallen short of that promise. The ways we've taken 2 strides forward and then suddenly had, you know, we've been shaken up and we've then taken a step or two back. This like any democracy is an imperfect one, but there are enough hopeful moments in our history to have a kind of a faith that if we just understand the value of our democracy and what it has delivered to us and what it would be like without it. And then to see how important it is not just to participate in these events like this referendum, but to actually take the trouble to understand it and then make our minds up. Our vote means so much more when we do and when we get the right outcome. And then we see the product of that outcome. In this case, I think there's very good reason to hope and expect that if Indigenous civilization, the 65,000 plus years of it, is enshrined in the Constitution, along with the voice as a permanent structure of advice to Parliament on Indigenous issues, I think there's every reason to expect that we will see those gaps closing as the Parliament learns a little better how to listen to Indigenous advice as part of the solution to all of these equations. We've all got a stake in it. We are all going to benefit from the better Australian we become. And the possibility for us to actually be, for the first time, a genuinely united nation of all the parts in it, all the many varied, complex and colourful parts in it, stand a little taller in the rest of the world.
Thomas, the Statement from the Heart is one of the most beautiful documents written in this country. And as you say in the handbook, the voice is a gift from the Aboriginal people to the nation. It's an invitation to work together. To people who don't see the voice as a gift, what would you say to them?
Well, if it's not that that will move them, I would ask them if it's acceptable that it is this country, Australia. We Australians have proportionately the most incarcerated people on the planet. That's here. That we have these disparities like twice the suicide rates, that youth, you know, taken from their families, youth in detention. For example, in the Northern Territory, almost all of the time, 100% of the children in youth detention are Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. Kerry and I have just been in the Clarence Valley, and someone that works at the youth detention centre there told me that it's 98% of the children are Indigenous. And so I would ask them if that's acceptable, if that's the sort of Australia that we want. I mean, you'd have to believe that we are less than human Indigenous people to accept that. If you accept that we are human like anyone else, and that we love our children like anyone else, that we're not innately criminal, then there must be a structural and political problem. There must be something that we can do as Australian people to close those gaps. And Indigenous people, with all of our wisdom and experience firsthand, having lived and breathed these issues, if we have come together in this, in a unique opportunity back in 2017 to have debate and discussions in an informed way and propose to Australians that this is the way that we can see that gap close, a practical change, an Australian way of doing things, putting a hand out to people and giving them a say, then why wouldn't you say yes to that? That's what I would say to them.
Kerry, you wrote forthrightly and honestly in the handbook about your own journey to the voice. And like many of us listening, myself included, we've grown up in a largely white Australia where Aboriginal people rarely featured. Through your life and your career, you've crossed a bridge to a better understanding of what Australia really is. And could you take us briefly through that journey?
Well, I grew up in Queensland. I had a good education, but by the time I'd left school and entered the workforce, my knowledge of Indigenous history, culture, tradition, civilization, and most particularly the colonial history of the interface between Indigenous Australians, first Australians, and the settlers, the white settlers, was one of total ignorance. I was completely ignorant of that history. There was nothing of that history represented in the textbooks of my time at school. It was only as a young journalist, as I started to travel and cover stories, a breadth of stories, and found myself in Alice Springs in 1970 on a story that had nothing to do with what I ended up spending most of my time observing and asking questions about, I was absolutely shocked to my core by what I saw there of the rawest of illustrations of racism, and of one people's treating another as if literally they had no worth, whatever, and of the powerlessness of those Indigenous people and the marginalisation, but the outcomes of that marginalisation, the trauma to which they were afflicted as a result of their dispossession. But these things are fundamental to the history of our country. They shouldn't overwhelm us any more than any other aspect of our history, but they are a really critical part of our history. And I try to say to people when we're talking about these things that the one thing that makes this country unique, genuinely unique over other nations, is the fact that we are home to the longest continuous civilization on the face of the planet. That is huge. And yet, settlement, a white settlement Australia, colonial and even post-colonial Australia for a long time, did its level best to destroy that civilization. For a very long time, there was an assumption amongst a comfortable and neat assumption amongst white Australian settlers that Indigenous people would inevitably die out over time because they simply weren't, quote unquote, up to our standard. That they would die out, and so there was this term called smoothing the dying pillow, which was about placing Indigenous people on reserves and in missions to, quote unquote, again, protect them while we waited for them to die. That is a part of the shocking nature of our history, which doesn't mean that I wear a hair shirt and whip myself and say, woe is me, not at all. But it is about having a full understanding of who and what we are. But having come to that understanding, what do we do to redress the deep imbalances and injustices that confront us every day? So my journey has been one through all those milestone moments of Indigenous white history, like, for instance, the movements of land rights in the late 60s, early 70s, and the first legislation on land rights through the Whitlam and then the Fraser governments, the Mabo decision, the Wick decision, both of which related to native title and were incredibly important. And in the case of both, we had the scare campaigns from people, as we did over land rights, where the catch cry was you were going to lose your suburban backyard. Or in the case of farmers and the Wick judgment on native title, that they were going to lose their family farms. None of those things came to pass because they were fundamentally, intrinsically false. They were false claims designed to play on ignorance, to scare people into opposing native title. And the same has been true with this campaign. There's this sort of fear being posed that somehow or other it's going to bring Parliament to its knees. It's going to dictate to Parliament, God knows how. It's going to bring the court system to a grinding halt. So, you know, I see these things from the perspective of somebody who had the scales removed from his eyes as a young man, and I've been learning ever since. And I just see this as an enormous opportunity for us to change history in a good way for all of us.
Well, look, that brings us to a part in the handbook, Kerry, where you said we, the Australian people, can't allow this referendum to descend into destructive, polarised, partisan politics that has made us all so weary, disillusioned in recent times. It's only a couple of days ago, John Howard said that the No campaign needs to maintain the rage. Are you feeling that it's already too late to stop the partisan culture war entering into this referendum?
I found that it was worse than ironic to hear John Howard use the term maintain your age. The person who said that as a figure of history was Gough Whitlam when his government had been undemocratically sacked by a Governor General. And when Gough stood on the steps of Parliament House and said to people, in a protection of our democracy, maintain your age, he was pilloried by the people on John Howard's side of politics. And for all I know, John Howard himself would have been critical of him using those terms. I think it is particularly detrimental, and I'm deeply disappointed in John Howard as a past leader of this country of some standing still, to actually use those words at a time when, because of the way some in the No campaign have sought to divide this nation around what they see as race, to have John Howard telling people to maintain their rage in opposing the voice, I think is dangerous. I think it is playing to the worst of us. It's playing to the worst of our fears and the worst of our human nature. I'm disappointed and deeply surprised that John Howard would go out of his way to use that terminology, particularly when you consider that in his 11 and a half years leading government, he sacked ATSIC, ripped hundreds of millions of dollars of vital infrastructure from the poorest of communities around this country, where he sent troops into the Northern Territory allegedly to fix a problem, only to see those problems made worse, where he sent uniformed troops onto the most vulnerable communities in this country allegedly to protect them, and the reverse occurred. You know, the policies, some of the things that John Howard did in his 11 and a half years are a part of the problems that we would want to try to fix by enshrining a voice in the Constitution and actually giving Indigenous people the voice. You know, if there was one uniform message that has emerged from Indigenous communities the most common message that's coming out of Indigenous communities to me is, we just want to be heard. We just want to be heard.
Thomas, I'm interested to hear from you on what you think of the former Prime Minister entering the debate in that fashion.
Oh, look, it's disgusting. I think Kerry couldn't have said it better, and you know, hit every point there. But for as a leader in the campaign that's trying to get people to vote yes, my focus is on helping people to understand what they're voting for here. There is nothing to be enraged about at all, but everything to embrace. I mean, it is really such a simple and modest proposition. You know, it's 92 words that will be inserted in the Constitution, and you can summarize it really easily. It's recognition and listening. That's it. That's all we're being asked to do, yes or no, to recognizing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people as we should have done long ago, and to do it in a way that gives them a say about decisions that are made about them, an advisory say. That's it. Yes or no to that. So, you know, Howard can say all he likes, but I hope that every listener listening to this will go and help people to understand that they've got nothing to lose and everything to gain by recognising Indigenous people and giving us an advisory voice to shape policies and laws and improve housing and health and education, infrastructure, water, you know, clean water, roads that don't bust a tyre just to take your kids to school, you know, every 3 months, reliable power and internet in remote communities and telecommunications, all of these things that have, for all of the politicians that are against this, that are saying, you know, we should just do this, when they were in power for almost 10 years and failed, you know, just get on with it. So people, join the campaign, yes23.com.au, get active, and that's the best response to Howard, is to succeed.
Kerry, the media will be central to the success or failure of The Voice. In a debate that could get more heated than it already is, how should the media cover this referendum?
In the way I would hope and expect, the media fulfills its responsibilities daily on every issue, by being straight, by being vigorous, by in their scrutiny, that if anybody on either side uses misinformation and lies, in some instances, deliberate lies, to try and make political capital or gain out of this, or to try and damage the other side, then they should be called out for it. I don't expect or believe that the media should line up on one side or the other, but I do believe that they should recognise their very clear responsibility for vigorous, accurate, questioning reporting, which applies a scrutiny, a proper scrutiny, to both sides. And you know, if that were to happen, if the media was doing its job really in this country, there would be far less confusion than there is. I've seen so much false information being circulated through the mainstream media without being properly scrutinised or called to account.
Yes, and look, that brings us to the ABC. I mean, the ABC is a hub of every culture war in this country, unfortunately, and The Voice is moving into that territory. Kerry, how do you think the ABC should cover The Voice, especially seeing that it's already receiving a lot of heat about the coverage that it's done?
Well, public, I'm not aware of what heat it's been subjected to over this. The thing about the ABC for any one individual person is that there are so many platforms and so many parts to it that it's hard to, you'd be sitting in one place 24 hours a day to be properly across every aspect of what the ABC is doing. I see enough of it through the main news coverage and some current affairs, some radio, a sort of sprinkling of radio and television, to think that in the main it's doing its job, but the same applies to the ABC as anybody else. You know, people get hung up over what balance is to give equal time to people. Giving equal time to two sides of a debate does not mean just handing over the platform or the space for that length of time. You've still got to apply vigorous journalism to your questioning. You don't just accept a statement simply because someone has said it. You've got to scrutinise, you've got to analyse faithfully, you've got to provide the backdrop, you've got to provide the perspective. You know, these things can sound simple, and in truth they really should be. But some, you know, I think a part of the problem, not just for the ABC, but for the whole of mainstream media, traditional mainstream media, is that the reporting that's required of individual journalists has stretched them to an extraordinary degree. I think there are fewer people in most newsrooms. Those newsrooms, on average, are much younger than they once were. There's no longer the level of experience in those newsrooms that there once was. There's a lot of young people, many of them very bright, very dedicated to their craft, but without the history in their heads and without the older mentors to refer to. So all of those things are a part of the problems that I see involved around the reporting of The Voice. I mean, how many of the reporters who are covering The Voice on a regular basis have any real understanding or grasp of the history of Indigenous relations in this country and the way non-Indigenous governments, predominantly white governments and white bureaucrats, have actually run their policy outcomes? What grasp do these journalists have on knowing how often policies have failed, not because of Indigenous people on the ground, but because the policymakers refused to listen to Indigenous advice in the first place? Which brings us back to why The Voice is so important and why it is particularly important that it's enshrined in the Constitution, so it sits there as a permanent institution, as part of the bedrock of our democracy, that it has the chance to grow, to mature, to evolve, that you can fix it up at the edges, you can make it better, you can make it stronger, you can learn from mistakes. Previous bodies of Indigenous advice did not have that luxury because most of them didn't last beyond the duration of the government that formed them. That's part of the problem. There's been too much change on Indigenous, on the capacity for Indigenous people to give advice, let alone to have that advice heard.
Thomas, this follows on from what Kerry just said. Thomas, do you feel that in the case of younger Aboriginal people who aren't supporting The Voice, do you think it's because they lack history where older Aboriginal people remember ATSIC being basically pulled apart and sacked?
Yeah, I think for some, certainly the reason. Because, you know, if you really understood our history, then, you know, I just can't see how anybody couldn't support something like this. So it is a factor for some. There's also a lack of trust, you know, not just for young people, but for some elders, right? We've seen so many broken promises. We've seen so many consultations that lead to nowhere. You know, that is why a few Indigenous people don't support this. But, you know, it's a minority. And I think that's what matters here, is that there is a clear consensus from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that this is the right way to go. We know that from the process that led to the making of the Uluru Statement, you know, a uniquely well-resourced, Indigenous-led process that covered the entire continent and adjacent islands, that, you know, had translators and support for people to come in off country, that had a formula applied to ensure there was cultural authority in the room and not just the loudest of our people skewing the results, but the quieter advocates, the healers, the frontline service workers. You know, this was that process endorsing this call and asking Australians to vote yes with us is greatly significant. But then there's also the polling that backs that. You know, over 80% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people will be voting yes. And so, you know, we're like any other group of human beings. We're going to get some that don't support it, some because they're uninformed, some because they just don't trust anything, some because they've got their own political ideals or aspirations. But, you know, for listeners to understand, you'll certainly be voting with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and in our interest.
Finally, Noel Pearson on the ABC this morning said that the Yes campaign will be about love and bringing Australians together. That strikes me as the almost radical idea after the last two decades of politics we've all lived through. The idea of bringing Australians together links back to our discussion earlier about The Voice as a gift to the Australian people. Do you both think we'll see a coming together over the next 44 days?
Yeah, I disagree that when people say that this is divisive. You know, I mean, obviously there's a cohort in this that are, you know, furiously working at convincing people that this is divisive and they're trying to cause confusion and all the rest. But ultimately, this is something that's unifying. And I'm not just talking about the results when it's successful being a unifying thing, unifying over 60,000 years of proud heritage and culture and history with our modern Australia is what constitutes us as Australians, but unifying in the referendum itself. I mean, if you cut through that noise and if you really look carefully you can see, you know, big corporates, you know, big business hand in hand with unions like mine. I'm from the Maritime Union of Australia, you know, what they call a militant union. So the union movement walking together with bosses. You've got all religious denominations, so, you know, walking together on this, praying together for this, you know, speaking in their, you know, to their congregations. You've got, and you've also got, you know, liberals and nationals that have resigned their positions and set back their careers to, you know, leaflet at train stations with Labor and the Greens. Who was it? We saw Tanya Plibersek with Malcolm Turnbull the other day, Julian Lisa with Penny Wong, I think, you know, just...
It was Julie Bishop and Penny Wong.
That's right, Julie
Bishop. What a sight of unity on an Australian stage. Two politicians who've been diametrically opposed to each other over decades. And what a powerful statement that was of unity.
So, you know, across the political spectrum, even politicians are walking together on this. There's just a few on the front bench of the coalition that are, you know, trying to convince people that this is divisive, but all I see is people coming together. You know, campaigners with people that have never been politically active before, you know, multicultural groups, many multicultural groups walking with the First Peoples on this. It's really unifying, and don't be convinced otherwise.
And frankly, I am confident. I'm actually increasingly confident that the Yes is going to get up on referendum day. And you don't have to be a genius to actually see what happens after that, because we've got the template for it in past referenda, most particularly, not referenda, but in the plebiscite for marriage equality not that long ago. There was a lot of division around, there were attempts to divide this nation around marriage equality leading up to that plebiscite. We were told that religious freedoms were going to be destroyed. We were told how it was going to divide Australia more than it was going to unite. And guess what? The plebiscite was resoundingly passed. And what's happened after that? If you were to conduct a similar plebiscite today, what was a 60%+ majority vote would be an 80 or 90% majority vote. And that not just the plebiscite, which probably wasn't even necessary, but then bringing that marriage, reflecting that plebiscite in the marriage equality reforms that followed, have absolutely united this nation in a much greater unity around those issues. Those gender issues that have dogged so many societies for so long. A matter of fairness, that was, and so is this, a matter of fairness. And you will see similarly, you will see people, you'll see the dust settle, you'll see the voice set up, you'll see it begin to work, you'll see the gap start to close, and you'll feel pretty good about being an Australian.
Look, on that note, I'd like to thank you both for a great discussion, Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien. Thank you for being on Fourth Estate.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks, Kerry.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Thomas Mayo and Kerry O'Brien's new book is called The Voice to Parliament Handbook and is in bookshops now. And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2RCR, heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back for more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU, and we're also on Threads. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Thanks for listening.